Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. President Trump's efforts to overturn the 2020 election results have been seen by many as an insurgency led from inside the Oval Office. His false claims of widespread election fraud boiled over into violence last week when a violent mob stormed the U.S. Capitol building, interrupting lawmakers as they tallied the Electoral College vote. His style is that of an authoritarian, and it isn't particularly novel. Ruth Ben-Ghiat is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her new book is titled Strongmen, Mussolini to the Present. Welcome to the show, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you.
The violence in the Capitol last week, I mean, we booked this well before that. It shocked many, not just in the U.S., but around the world. Were you watching the scenes as they unfolded, and what did you think?
I wasn't surprised. I was really calm, and I kind of went into analytic mode. It's shocking and horrifying, but I was angry that some of these insurgents just went out and had a beer after in D.C. and Kansas. But I wasn't surprised, because this is the logical result of many things that Trump has been trying to do and many things he's been preaching for 4 years.
What happened last week, it's been said, is a precursor to something worse. And is there a parallel here as far as escalation goes that we can look to in history?
Yeah, when he gave his, that's January 7th speech and said, our journey's just beginning, there I wasn't surprised either, because I think that this is the beginning of a period of where he could act as an outside agitator and continue to rile up groups within the GOP and outside extremists to destabilize democracy and delegitimize the Biden administration. Unfortunately, so the historical precedent that comes to mind, it's not perfect, because every situation has unique things,
right.
But actually in Chile, everyone knows about the U.S.-backed coup of 1973 that brought dictatorship to Chile for 17 years. But when Salvador Allende came in as socialist president in 1970, it was a U.S.-backed effort, but there was a lot of Chileans obviously involved. There was a concerted attempt through violence, through psychological warfare, economic measures to make Chile as difficult to govern and unstable as possible, to create the desire in the public for authoritarian rule. So I see this as a playbook, which ironically built on, CIA and American know-how in psychological and other warfare. I see this as something that could be repeated, to bring, to enable the Republicans to recapture the White House in 2024.
The idea that a public in a democratic society desires authoritarianism is a shocking notion to a lot of people. We've heard, obviously it can't happen here, is what we immediately think. What about the Trump presidency and his candidacy before that worked on people to, we've heard now people say on the record, yeah, I wouldn't mind an authoritarian regime here.
Yeah, so historically, what happens is when men like Trump come on the political scene, and sometimes they come from outside of politics, and my book, The Strong Men, looks at patterns in society, and we're just the latest nation to not see what was in front of us or not want to see, or some people liked what they saw, but not have reckoned adequately with the appetite for a personality like Trump. So when they come to power, they start right when their campaigns in the 20th century, because they have to run for office, they start to legitimize all existing anti-democratic and extremist tendencies. So Trump started signaling, in 2015 to the people who were assaulting the Capitol on January 6th by retweeting neo-Nazi memes. And that was the first piece I did on Trump for CNN was November 2015 on this call out to extremists, because as a historian of fascism, I realized that this was really bad news.
There are strong men, and then there are strong men whose power wanes. And how does the president's rhetoric leading up to and since the election of 2020 fit into that dynamic?
In every which way. I mean, from it really, it's what's astounding is what's happened in these two very long months has drawn from all eras of authoritarian history. And I want to make clear for listeners that, you know, Trump, it's as though he takes from a whole century of authoritarianism, not that he's reading a manual because he doesn't read, as we all know, but so he has the kind of fascist, you know, insurgents. So he evokes early fascism. And in fact, what we're seeing and the call for another armed march is like, it reminds me of the March on Rome, which started fascism, right? You have these paramilitaries. So he evokes that, but he also explored, as we know, a military coup, right? And then General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, shut that down. And so what he's been trying to do corresponds to the new age of authoritarianism, where they come in through elections and then they manipulate or try and, you know, delegitimize elections to stay there. So he is somebody who quite the contrary to people say he's incompetent. He actually has used very effectively all of these tactics from a century of authoritarianism to create to delegitimize the idea of elections. And he started this in 2016, saying elections were rigged in case he lost. So we've had 5 years, if you count his campaign time, for people to be indoctrinated with all of these beliefs of including the necessity of violence to move history forward. And that's where we are now.
We are talking about the history of authoritarianism around the world and in the 20th century. My guest is Ruth Benguiat. She's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her new book is titled Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. It was published in November. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Polls released last week show most Americans rejected the assault on the Capitol. However, a majority or plurality of Trump voters feel that the actions of the mob were either mostly right or that rioters went too far, but that they had a point. Mm-hmm. I wonder what that tells you about the sturdiness of our democracy at this point. And also, is it, you know, an authoritarian regime or working towards one requires it's a larger calculation than just one person. There's a place, a time in our society, right, that's making us particularly vulnerable to this?
Yeah, so one of the patterns that emerged, and this is it's extraordinary because it's around the globe, 100 years, so many case studies, is men like Trump have an appeal when there's been a period of great progress in society. Either, and that means something different for every place, right? Mm-hmm. But either gender emancipation, racial equity, ethnic and minorities who are starting to get to power, workers' rights. And so in many countries, you could say it's white male authority that's threatened, status is threatened, elites feel their privileges are going to end. And so you have a dynamic where, and elites are often the ones to invite these insurgents, these extremists like Trump into the system. And this happened, you know, in Italy with fascism and Germany with Hitler, and it happened with the GOP, where they thought they could use Trump. And it was like a mutual using. So, but of course, the joke is that then the outsider takes over. And Trump, historical comparison is very interesting because Trump has succeeded to an astonishing degree to domesticate the GOP and make it the tool of his personal needs and desires. And the reason I say it's astonishing is that Mussolini founded his own party. Berlusconi, who I have in the book, who didn't, he's a good analogy for Trump, he didn't succeed in destroying democracy, but he had an autocratic way of being prime minister. He founded his own party. But Trump came from outside, and in less than 4 years, he really changed the political culture of the GOP and turned it into his own tool. And so without this, we can't explain the behavior of Republicans who thought everything was just fine that he did. And some of them think that even this is fine. And no method. When you have a lawless political culture, which is what Trump has brought and enabled, no method is off the table. And this is the essence of authoritarian rule, that any method is all right, no matter the bloodshed it causes, no matter the disruption, if you get what you want.
So he didn't have to establish his own party, which is extremely difficult to do in the United States anyways. Others have tried, but he hollowed out an existing party and filled that vacuum.
He hollowed it out. And that's an interesting phrase that scholars use too, meaning it's often used for government. And in fact, we haven't even begun to digest the extent to which across federal agencies, he has, they have fired experts, fired people who don't think the way they do, made hostile work environments, so forced people to resign. These are autocratic capture methods that have been applied. And the scope of it is not even known, I think.
It's still going on, some believe.
It's still going on. And then you staff them with lackeys, with corrupt people. So I added a corruption chapter to my book, which is not just about financial corruption. It's about complicity and moral corruption. Because the more you have people who, for example, all the people who violate the Hatch Act, who thought that Wilbur Ross not declaring his conflicts of interest was fine, the more you have people who are corrupt and unscrupulous in government, the more you get away with doing what you need to do. So corruption is like a contagion. So this has also gone on within the GOP, which always was, it hit one of the big points in the book and many people are talking about. The GOP was already, had already become a far-right party in many ways, with one foot outside of the political culture of democracy when Trump came along. And this is going to be a bigger and bigger story in the future, where they really were not that interested in bipartisan governance. And they, backed up by right-wing media universe, they had lost the idea of respecting the political opposition. Now that's why when Trump came along and started with his lock her up, which is something you don't say that you're going to lock up your rival. You only do that in autocracies. You don't say that in democracies. The GOP was fine with it. And so we have to think of that. And what he did is he added the leader cult, and he added the ability of one individual to entice people to be corrupt, to entice them with lawlessness, but also to be like a protector and a defender. And so he bound people to him, important people like, William Barr and Lindsey Graham. So this is the journey of the Republican Party that had already started, and he kind of accelerated it.
We are talking about the history of authoritarianism in the 20th century. And of course, we're talking about that in the context of President Donald Trump. My guest is Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her new book, published in November, is titled Strong Men, From Mussolini to the Present. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We'll be right back. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher.
La tua tenacia! Il tuo coraggio! Il tuo valore!
That's a recording of Italian dictator Benito Mussolini in June 1940, rousing his followers to war with France and Great Britain. The fascist leader was famous for his balcony speeches, which he delivered in military garb and with over-the-top bravado that enraptured his followers. Such cults of personality have been the hallmark of authoritarians across the ages and around the world. Still with us is Ruth Ben-Ghiat. She's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her new book is titled Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Ruth, you use the word strong men in the title, is the title of your book. Why did you pick that word versus authoritarian? What's the power of that word and why does it resonate?
So strong men are, I see them as a subset of authoritarians. And authoritarians are rulers who, the executive branch overwhelms and sometimes completely crushes the freedom of the other branches of society. And there's leader cults, but strongmen do these things on a continuum. And so there are people in the book like Berlusconi in Italy and Trump in the 21st century who don't, you know, we don't have as many one party states anymore. But strongmen do these things, but they also use machismo and virility and male bluster as a tool. And so the book talks about this kind of toolkit that they all use to rule: propaganda, corruption, machismo, violence, and the myth of national greatness. So I wanted to take this kind of toxic masculinity seriously because it's very important part of how they present themselves to their followers. It's a source of their appeal. And it's also important in their relations with other male leaders. And Trump fits this formula perfectly.
How did you decide which characters to focus on for the book?
So I have a lot of people in the book, but I started as a historian of fascism. So most of them are right-wing authoritarians. That doesn't mean that left-wing authoritarians didn't do, you know, huge amounts of mass murder, if you think of Stalin and Pol Pot. But I wanted to show the connections among these leaders. So, for example, I have the fascists. And then I look at how Francisco Franco in Spain, a lot of neo-fascists and neo-Nazis went to Spain. They didn't all go to Argentina and Paraguay, and how Franco continued this. And then when he died, you had Pinochet, who came in. Now we're in the age of military coups, but a lot of neo-fascists and neo-Nazis who'd been in Spain now went to Chile, as well as other places where you had juntas. So I try and show that there are these links that go up to our present day, that go up to our present day with somebody like Bolsonaro in Brazil, who is a right-wing authoritarian who glorifies their military dictatorship. And these we're living in a time of intense historical revisionism. And I wanted to kind of pull back the curtain and show the violence of these regimes, the inefficiency, and the destruction that they cause.
Yeah. Speaking of inefficiency, a lot of people think that having a dictator, an authoritarian rule, hey, just get the job done, a really strong executive role in a government. And that has not necessarily is for sure not the case, even though that's something that they put forth as an asset or an attribute.
Yeah. So, one of the things the recurrences I didn't necessarily expect to find was they all set up, and Trump is included, these kind of inner sanctums or cocoons where they have flatterers and family members. So I have a paragraph on sons-in-law from Mussolini's son-in-law Ciano up to Jared Kushner. And the purpose of these cocoons is because these men all have the same personality. The outcome is very different according to the, you know, old dictatorships versus the way things work today. But the personality is the same. And one of the things is that they can't have any criticism. They're extremely threatened by criticism and by anyone who's too competent. So the best way to get fired or demoted or transferred working for someone who's the strongman is to be too popular or too competent. But this governance structure, which you see in every single leader I cover, it leads them to make bad decisions, and they end up believing their own propaganda. And so Mussolini, you had the audio clip of him going into war. He went into war in 1940 on Hitler's side against the advice of all of his generals. But he didn't care. He didn't listen to them. And we all know what happened. You know, he was booted out and then he was eventually killed. So this kind of refusal to listen to have any critical feedback, the idea Mussolini famously said, I follow my instinct and I'm never wrong. And Trump says, someone asked him during the campaign, who do you consult with on foreign policy? And he says, I can consult with myself because I have a big, beautiful brain. So the signs were there that he was going to act in the same way. And often these people are the last to realize that they are losing power. And when they do, they become vindictive and extremely dangerous, as we've seen in our country in the last months.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. I'm speaking with historian Ruth Ben-Ghiat. Her new book is titled Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. It was published in November. If you have a question or comment, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Jason and Hilliard, you're on the air. Hi, Jason.
Hi there. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
My question is, it seems like that Trump comments a lot on Antifa and what they do, but it seems like he's encouraging a lot of that behavior, you know, amongst his own followers. But I'm wondering if that's a pattern among authoritarians.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
So it's been really interesting and horrifying to see what Trump has done, where he has taken old enemies of the American people, of let's say white people, some white people who had as their enemies people of color, African Americans, or they didn't like migrants, and these were people who always were the target and through policing, etc. And what he did, which is out of the authoritarian playbook, is to add new enemies. And one of them is the press. The press became a political enemy. Protesters who get lumped together. So you, as all people who go out and do nonviolent protests suddenly become rioters or terrorists. And so they become political enemies. And so this is part of this authoritarian mentality. You're either with us or against us. And journalists found this during the Black Lives Matter protests when they went out as journalists to cover it, and they were treated as enemies. They were assaulted. They were detained. And so when you look at the language that Trump uses against the left, and there's also this is because you have to have polarization. You can't have any liberals anymore. Everybody becomes the radical left. Even Nancy Pelosi, who wears pearls, is the radical left. But when you look at this rhetoric, it matches very closely, which is scary, the rhetoric of right-wing authoritarians from the fascist years, from Pinochet, from Franco. Some of the speeches that William Barr gives and some of the things Trump says, they have a long history, and it never ends well, this history.
You know, you mentioned we he didn't read the playbook because, you know, as you mentioned, he doesn't read. But he does have aides around him who are very astute when it comes to the historical record. I mean, how much do you think he is coached?
Yeah, I didn't actually realize. I knew all about Steve Bannon. I'd already written op-eds about him, mm-hmm. Who's dedicated his life to not only white nationalism, which we all know, but to a global attempt to take down democracy. he's allied with people all over the world. For a while, he was based in Europe to do this. But I didn't realize that some of the people who have coached Trump for years, like Roger Stone and Paul Manafort, they had a lobbying. They used to work for dictators.
Right.
They had a lobbying firm, and I write this in the book. So they worked for Mobutu in the Congo, who's in my book as a protagonist. They worked for Ferdinand Marcos, and lo and behold, how did they work for Marcos? They were hired on the occasion of a snap election, he called, because he was feeling like his power was slipping away, and it was widely accused of fraud. So here we have people who are experts in psychological warfare, in smear campaigns, and in fraudulent elections, and in white right-wing ideology, and worked for right-wing dictators. So Trump has around him, even without his own skill at propaganda, his own historic racism, his own authoritarian personality, he has around him a lot of people who actually channel the history of this. And that's another reason why I wanted to write this book, to show that American history is not the only frame, is not a sufficient frame for understanding the scope of the danger represented by Trump. We have to, that's why he's got neo-Nazis. One of the insurgents had a Camp Auschwitz t-shirt on. So we need to have a broader frame for understanding those around him who are, whose mission is to take down democracy.
Let's see. Thank you, Jason, for that call. Katira in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Katira.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
I have a quick question concerning the turnover for the new administration. For President-elect Biden, he has an incoming administration with quite a few minorities. He's appealing to minorities in America, which seems to be almost the opposite effect with Trump, who it kind of utilizes race to his advantage in gaining his gaining his group and gaining his following. So my question is, especially for the Biden administration and even Kamala Harris, as Professor Bengia was pointing out, kind of the male machismo and this need of toxic masculinity, how will they or should they consolidate their power to the best of their ability to gain the influence?
Yeah, I think Katira's question is really interesting because what does history tell us about the opponents of these kinds of movements and how they fare in the immediate?
I mean, Biden will have his own administration, and so obviously he has huge challenges, but sending a very strong message about the necessity of undoing and refuting Trump's racism is obviously key, and it's excellent that Kamala Harris will be vice president, but it has to be, what Trump's been doing for 4 years is also waging psychological warfare, especially on people of color. All of those photos, hundreds of photos of white men, who are crowding the House of Power was a kind of a rage reaction to a former president, Barack Obama, who many of those people thought should never have been elected. And this was the big historical circumstance that allowed Trump to get so much support that sadly many people thought that Barack Obama had no right to be president. And so we've been seeing these photographs of kind of hegemonic whiteness. And so the Biden administration has a really big job to do to project a different America that is much more consonant with who we are, especially given the demographic realities.
Katira, thanks for that call. I have some emails. I actually have a lot of emails. Does your guest consider Trump to be a one-off presidential figure unique to current circumstances or instead a representative figure likely to be repeated in the future? That's from Peter in Grandview Heights.
Yeah, that's a great question, mm-hmm. Peter. I think that in some ways he's unique, and I certainly don't mean that Americans would not like to have someone else who's a law and order figure. The uniqueness of Trump came from his background in entertainment. So one of the things that you find about these men who succeed at being strongmen, they not only, many of them are criminals, they have like criminal records when they come to power, but they also, surprising number, have a background in media. So Mussolini was a journalist, so was Mobutu. So Trump had been in entertainment, as we all know, very, very skilled marketer, very skilled propagandist. So it's difficult if you think of some of the other people who think they would like to be a law and order president, like Hawley or Cruz, they don't have that ability. So Trump is unusual in that sense. And also people believed he was a successful billionaire. But the danger of Trump is that, of course, that he's opened the floodgates. You can use many different images. He's lowered the bar. He's allowed lawlessness to become legitimized. And all the things he's doing, including, you know, trying to invalidate the election, are a roadmap for others to follow. Many people say the danger is more acute when you get somebody who seems less like a clown or a blusterer and is more efficient. And that may be true. That happened in Italy when Berlusconi brought the far right, these former neo-fascist party, into power. The head of that far right party, Gianfranco Fini, who used to be out there in the piazzas with his, you know, black shirt and Roman salute, he totally changed that, and he only wore very tailored, beautiful Italian suits and aviator frames. So he became like legitimized and normalized. And so there is a danger of somebody else coming along and being a quieter and more efficient Trump.
My guest is Ruth Benghiat. She is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her new book is titled Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking about the rise of authoritarian rulers through the 20th century to the present and the authoritarian tendencies of President Trump. Still with us is Ruth Benghiat. She's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her new book is titled Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. It was published in November. We have lots of calls and we have lots of emails, but I did want to talk to you a bit before that about what, if there's any reforms the U.S. could ever adopt to protect our democracy from these chinks?
Yeah, well, the, you know, the silver lining, as such that it is that Trump and his, those he's appointed, his methods, have left us a pretty clear roadmap of all of the weaknesses of our democracy and our ways of doing things, not just combating extremism, because, you know, there were many studies. The FBI had studies about the infiltration of the law enforcement and the military into white extremist groups. And so one of the things is Biden can establish a commission, a national commission, to investigate that and address that. But also corruption. It's very bad for the country when one of the things that Trump was there to do, he was never there to govern as a traditional president. He was there first and foremost to make money for Trump Organization. That's why he golfed one out of every 3 days of his presidency or visited a Trump branded property. So, and many of the people he hired had conflicts of interest. I mentioned Wilbur Ross, Commerce Secretary. And so we need much better vetting. We need sanctions for people who refuse to, you know, fill out their security clearance forms properly. All of these things, these small and larger things that are normative that we must uphold if we're going to have rule of law in our country.
Alan in Clintonville, you're on the air. Hi, Alan.
Yes, Rick Steve, the travel guy, did a special on fascism, late 20s, early 30s, end of the 40s, and about 2 months ago, which was really eye-opening, and I would recommend anybody in your audience to go back. It was, I think it was an hour presentation, but it really opened my eyes to what was going on today. So, yeah, it's Rick Steves. He's the NPR travel guy.
Yep, absolutely. So, Alan, thanks for
definitely
that.
Definitely recommend that.
Yeah, thanks for the suggestion. It's interesting the way Alan just put that. It really opened his eyes to what's going on kind of right in front of our face around the world. We're so focused in this country. We're a huge country, for one thing, and we're so focused on what's right in front of us, which is a lot, that there's just all kinds of stuff going on out there that Americans aren't maybe as aware of as they might have been.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. And the way I wanted to structure it is I have a first part about how they get to power in different ages, but each chapter goes over 100 years, which made it much harder to write. But I wanted people to be able to see, for propaganda, for example, what is the same, like personality cults. Like, it's quite extraordinary how little the canons of the personality cult have changed. But what has changed? You know, what's different? Obviously, social media and other things, and this conspiracy theories. Because what we're going through now has a history, and there are lessons we can take from that history to combat and overcome what we're going through today. But we can only do that if we have a shift of our thinking. If we are only focused on democracy as a frame of reference, we can't understand Trump and what's going on. And I think that obviously January 6th has been a wake-up call in that regard, but everything we've been talking about on this show, if you see him in an authoritarian framework, that means that not only you look back to see how he conforms to past practice, but you can have a sense of what he will do. And I'm sorry to say that I've, you know, been predicting before he was inaugurated in 2017, I wrote a CNN op-ed called Trump is Following the Authoritarian Playbook. And I've been correct in all of my predictions, which gives me zero joy because it's never good things. But I've been able to do that and warn people because of the knowledge of the past. So Americans are used to being able to take their democracy for granted and can't do that anymore.
Joe in Dayton, you're on the air. Hi, Joe.
Hi, and thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Yeah, my question was around the reaction that we're having now, some of the Democrats and Republicans, about the takeover of the Capitol building. And is that really going to have an impact on the support that Trump has had in the past, which was, what, 35% or 40%? But how about the next 10 or 15% that finally got him over the hill as far as becoming president?
You're saying that he will lose some of those people.
I'm hoping that. And do I have, is my hope lost, or is that going to happen?
I think you're correct. Because one of the reasons that I think the GOP is so angry at Trump is that he took to an extreme. He took the gloves off of all of the things that they've been doing in a quiet, genteel, not really, but more genteel way. And so he kind of like ruined the party for many of them. And this last event, this insurrection that cost lives, kind of showed them that they can't support him anymore. And, you know, make no mistake, though, that people like Pence and McConnell, who were with him throughout all the illegal things he did, all the brutality, they only mobilized when they saw their own physical safety was threatened, which is typical behavior in authoritarian history. But they're also, they want to make sure that the GOP, he doesn't wreck the GOP. What they're interested in is preserving all of the things they've gained under Trump and pursuing this minority rule. So that's, you know, that's also part of it.
Even though over the weekend, the RNC met down in Florida, and President Trump called in for about a minute, and he was met with an ovation by those gathered there. I mean, they still embrace him openly.
Yeah, so this is, again, this is why we really can't understand the relationship of Trump and not just his grassroots followers who, and this was so sad that, you know, they went like sheep into his rallies and wore no masks just to be loyal to him. And for somebody like Trump, with the ego he has, what better joy than to see people risking their lives for him? But it's also the elites. And again, this is a kind of leader-follower relationship that you can't understand in democratic terms. They are, you know, it's one of the articles that most affected me was after the Senate acquitted Trump, which was a milestone. Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown went around to his colleagues and asked them why they did it. And guess what they said? They said that they were scared. They were intimidated. They were bullied into voting for him. So Trump has used, you know, blackmail, he's used intimidation, threats of them losing their you know, seats. And they also are very bonded to his, some of them are very invested in the style of politics that they are drunk on the power that they think it can bring them and on his person. They're bonded to his person. And this is all not really legible in the history of democracy.
Joe in Dayton, thanks for that call. Robert has an email. He says, hi, Ann. Can guests describe the tipping point beyond which the strong man can't be stopped? How close to it does she think we may be?
Well, Robert, a note of cheer in all of this gloom and doom is that we did something extremely rare in history where we voted out somebody who was in the middle of a process of autocratic capture. Had he had a second term, I think, you know, now people see this more clearly, but he would have implemented all kinds of criminalizing dissent, locking up journalists. I have no doubt about that. So we already interrupted this to some extent. But now we have an immediate threat of taming this extremism and taming this violence, which, you know, he's going to have to leave. But the movements that he fostered, he won't have the presidential power to, he's gone. But it's more things that have to be done on a political and social level.
David and Warren, you're on the air. Hi, David.
Hello. I have a comment. She was talking about the media in all this. A couple years ago, CBS had a special about Watergate on the anniversary, and they played a Watergate tape where Richard Nixon is heard saying, also never forget, the press is the enemy. The press is the enemy. The press is the enemy. Write that on a blackboard 100 times and never forget it. And then he closed with, you must keep up the attack on the enemy. You must keep destroying their credibility.
Yeah. Talk about making my blood run cold, David. that is a 20th century, 21st century phenomenon, attacking the press.
This is one of the constants that every single authoritarian does it. And it's very important that they start doing it while they're still coming to power. And this is what Trump did, of course. And this is what I mean by he added new enemies, political enemies, the press. He made them into a political enemy to the older enemies that people were familiar with. And the reason they have to do this is that they're all very corrupt. And when evidence of their corruption comes out or their past, they need the public to already think of journalists as partisan hacks, so they won't be believed. And Trump ended up admitting this to Leslie Stahl in an interview. He said, "I wanted to discredit you so no one would believe you." So Trump, this is an example I was saying before, where Trump says the things that are not supposed to be said. So he kind of wrecks the party and people get mad at him for that. But this is another way in which the experience of America under Trump connects to history and contemporary things. This is what Putin kills journalists. Erdogan in Turkey locks up journalists, dozens and dozens of them, or they have to flee. Trump's on record, the book that John Bolton wrote and another book, as saying numerous times in private, I mean, in meetings, that he thinks that journalists should be executed. They're scumbags. So I think we have dodged a bullet in terms of that by not giving him a second term.
Ron and Logan, we're just about out of time, but I wanted to squeeze you in. Hi, Ron.
How are you?
Good, thanks. Go ahead. We're running out of time. Want to get you in.
Yes. I don't think there's any comparison, as the professor has professed here. Strong arm man, Trump, in comparison to Mussolini. I think that's a long shot. I think it's just a guessing game. There's no crystal ball. There's no proof that he has ever been an authoritarian. It's all hearsay, basically.
Okay.
But, I look at the indictments coming down into the Biden family. I think it's going to intercept anything we're talking about today that involves Trump and his character.
Okay.
Or what think the people are calling his demeanor to be. What's there again? No truth to the matter. We had 4 years of nonsense that panned out to be absolutely negative as far as any collusion or conspiracy with Russia. And this is just a runoff. The Russia thing.
Ron, I do not want to cut you off, but unfortunately your call came in late, and I want to give Professor Ben-Ghiat a chance to respond. We're just about out of time. We have about a minute.
I would just say that it can seem like it's a crazy thing to say that Trump is like Mussolini or these others. And in fact, I never called Trump a fascist, because every era, authoritarianism works differently in every era. Today, you don't have dictatorships. You don't have, except North Korea and China and communist states. But that's the thing of the past. You don't wreck the opposition totally. You keep some of them there. So it looks different. Trump, all the things he's done, I don't see him as anything but an authoritarian. But one of the beauties of America is that you can agree to disagree.
Ruth Ben-Ghiat, professor of history and Italian studies at New York University. Her latest book is Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Wow. It was published in November. Thanks a lot for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And that's it for now. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.